Welcome to Menopause Reimagined. I'm your host, Andrea Donsky. I'm a nutritionist for almost 20 years. I'm in menopause. I'm a menopause researcher, menopause educator, and I'm the co-founder of WeAreMorphous.com, a company that helps to empower you to take control of your health and symptoms with nutrition, lifestyle, supplements, and research. Speaking about research, I would be super grateful if you took a minute to fill out our newest survey, which is called Doctor Visits, as well as all of our menopause research surveys. I put a link to them below, and I'll be sharing the results on future podcasts. Today, I'm speaking with Mark Mattson, PhD. He's the former chief of the Laboratory of Neurosciences at the National Institute on Aging, and is currently adjunct professor of neuroscience at Johns Hopkins University School of Medicine. His research has advanced an understanding of the molecular and cellular mechanisms that control the formation and plasticity of neurons in the brain, and their involvement in brain aging and neurodegenerative disorders. He's also explained how the brain responds and adapts to challenges such as fasting and exercise, and he's used that information to develop unique interventions to promote optimal brain function throughout life. Dr. Mattson is among the most highly cited neuroscientists in the world, and he was elected a Fellow of the American Association for the Advancement of Science and is a recipient of the Metropolitan Life Foundation Medical Research Award and the Alzheimer's Association Zenith Award. He's the author of the books The Intermittent Fasting Revolution and Sculptor and Destroyer. He's also the host of Brain Ponderings podcast. Now, here's Mark. Welcome to Menopause Reimagined, Mark.
It's nice to be with you, Andrea.
I'm really excited that I found you because I'm in the middle of writing a book, and it's a book about menopause. And in my research, as I was talking about intermittent fasting, I came across some of your papers. I reached out to you, and I'm so grateful that you were able to come on our podcast so you can share your research. So why don't we start with what inspired you to go along, you know, to research brain health and everything that you're so passionate about?
Yeah, I'm a neuroscientist. I started out actually studying how neural connections form during brain development. And then I did a lot of work showing that actually the most important neurotransmitter in the brain, which many of your viewers and listeners may not have heard of, it's called glutamate. It's an amino acid. And I actually wrote a book since I retired on that. But anyway, it turns out that glutamate can kill neurons when it activates them, excites them too much, process called excitotoxicity. So then I got interested in neuronal degeneration and brain aging and Alzheimer's disease. And back in the 90s, we had a few experimental animal models, rats and mice, where we could cause degeneration of the neurons that die in Alzheimer's disease or in Parkinson's disease or in a stroke, actually, which we just occlude the blood vessel. So age, advancing age is the major risk factor for all three of those brain disorders. They affect mainly elderly people, including obviously elderly women. And so it was known at the time that one way to seemingly slow down the aging process and extend lifespan was caloric restriction or intermittent fasting. There was a study done by a colleague of mine at the National Institute on Aging. I was a lab chief at the National Institute on Aging for decades. And he found that every other day food deprivation or every other day fasting can extend the lifespan in rats and mice by up to 50%. So then we asked, okay, can we protect neurons against dysfunction and degeneration in our animal models of Alzheimer's, Parkinson's, and stroke by putting them on an intermittent fasting feeding regimen? And we found we could. So we published those studies beginning in the late 1990s and early 2000s. And then we spent a lot of time trying to figure out what's going on in the brain that explains these beneficial effects. But then what happened was I got approached by a number of physicians who were doing clinical studies, clinical trials, and they were interested in doing trials of intermittent fasting. And the first one we did was in overweight people with asthma. Actually, most of them were women. And it was a small study, but we published in 2007, and we found that if we maintain these asthma patients on, what we did is every other day they ate only 500 calories. So it's like every other day you're not eating much, right? It's like one moderate sized meal. And we found over 2 months their asthma symptoms improved, their airflow in their lungs improved. And then in my lab, we in blood samples from these patients, we measured various things and found that indicators of inflammation and oxidative stress were reduced. Okay, then we did a study with a group in England. Michelle Harvey was the head of the study. Again, we helped with doing a lot of blood work. And that was in 100 overweight women. Most of them were like, I'd say middle age, young to middle age, like 30 to 50, that range. And they were randomly assigned to either eating breakfast, lunch, and dinner, but each meal eating about 20 to 25% fewer calories than they normally do. So they're, spacing out their meals, breakfast, lunch, dinner. And then the other group, we had them 2 consecutive days a week. They only ate 600 calories each day. And we call that actually, we call it intermittent energy restriction in the study. But then that was actually that study that led to the popularization of intermittent fasting as a thing on the internet. Because what happened was, so I mentioned this was a group in England. When we published the findings, I finished to say, both the caloric restriction, daily caloric restriction, breakfast, lunch, and dinner, and the intermittent fasting group lost weight over 6 months, about the same amount of weight, 8% on average of their initial body weight. They had improvements in glucose regulation, but the women with the intermittent fasting, they had a greater improvement significantly in their glucose regulation, their insulin sensitivity. So anyway, this producer, Michael Mosley at the BBC, picked up on this, and he did a documentary that aired in 2013 that's called Eat Fast, Live Longer. It came to my lab at the NIH and a couple other investigators' labs. And then he tried a couple different approaches to intermittent fasting and kind of settled on this 5-2 intermittent fasting. And he did blood work on him and stuff. But anyway, so when after that aired, then that started to become a thing on the internet. There's a lot of chatter. So if you would have Googled intermittent fasting, say in 2010 or so, before we started publishing the first human trials, you would have got some scientific articles like ours and a few other labs. But now, if you Google intermittent fasting, it's actually hard to find the actual science. If you just Google intermittent fasting, you'll get a lot of these random people that, But anyway, I kind of view intermittent fasting like exercise. It's a lifestyle approach that can improve general health, including brain health. What's most commonly done now is people will, and this is what I think it's easiest for people, and it seems to be effective for general health, is daily time-restricted eating, where one compresses the time window each day that they eat their food, say to 6 to 8 hours. I do 6 hours eating window. I've done that for actually before I even started this research. Just accidentally, I skipped eating breakfast and then haven't eaten breakfast since. So I ate all my food like between noon and six. And I usually exercise in the late morning, like after we do this podcast recording, I'll exercise for an hour in the fasted state, right? Since I haven't eaten since six yesterday. Anyway, I found like when I was in the lab, I get up early, go to the lab like Sometimes I get up at 5, but 6, go to the lab. And I found out I was most productive in the morning in the fasted state. And I can't talk about this study much now because it's under review now, but we've done a study looking at effects of intermittent fasting on cognition. And then we did a lot of MRI imaging of the brain and some analyses of cerebral spinal fluid, the fluid that bathes the brain. And anyway, there's some beneficial effects. Oh, and that was all in people between the ages of 55 and 70.
Amazing. When
And
exactly, when do you think that review will be released, or how does that
that
work?
article, well, it's under review now, and I don't want to jinx us, but we revised the manuscript and sent it back and are waiting for
Amazing.
like a final decision. But
I'm so
anyway,
excited to see
and there are
that.
other groups now. There's if you would have went on clinicaltrials.gov in 2010 and put in intermittent fasting, that's maybe less than a handful of studies. Now, if you go on there are over 200 studies in cancer, a lot in obesity, type 2 diabetes, a lot of inflammatory disorders, and so on. So anyway.
Amazing.
We'll be right back. Hi, I'm Sunu Bigelow of Bigelow Tea, and I'm here to introduce you to our newest line called Bigelow Benefits. I love them all. We have stress-free, and I say, who doesn't want to be stress-free? Stay well, perfect for this time of year. Calm stomach, sleep, another important one, and our newest, throat defense. So try any one of them. You can buy them on Amazon or BigelowTea.com. I guarantee you, you will love them all.
You know, you were saying before, because there are different, for those of you who are listening and you're maybe not familiar with intermittent fasting, I have done other interviews and I'm going to post them below if you need a bit of a 101. But what's amazing to me, Mark, is that there are so many methods of intermittent fasting. Like you were saying before, there's the 5-2 where you're eating regularly for 5 days and then 2 days where you're restricting your calories. Is it say like between 500 and 700 calories a day? I think so. And then there's also the 16-8, there's the 18-6, like, so there's different ways that you could do it. So restricting it for 8 hours, eating in the 8 hour window, eating in the 6 hour window. So you could do it in different formats. Have you found, and you said that you alluded to this before, but have you found that it works better when you're doing a specific method, or is it just the general idea of restricting your eating windows to a certain time so it gives your body a chance to, you know, repair, recover, and take a rest?
Yeah, that's a great question. And at this point, there haven't been direct comparisons in the same study
Okay.
of, daily time restricted eating versus 5-2. I mentioned we did a comparison where it's a no fasting but reduced calorie intake versus intermittent fast. So we can't say. I think daily time restricted eating is the easiest for most people. And it takes a while, several weeks, maybe up to a month for a person to get adapted. And by I mean adapted for the neuroendocrine systems that control their appetite, their hunger. There's a lot of changes that go on during the first several weeks when you initiate intermittent fasting. It's kind of like if you've So there's this adaptation period. It's very important for people to know this because some people will, they'll start skipping breakfast when they've always eaten breakfast before, and they'll be like hungry and irritable in the morning, can't concentrate. And it's because their systems aren't adapted. After several weeks to a month, they'll find that they're no longer hungry in the morning.
Yeah, and that's a good point. Sorry to interrupt you. I just want to interject is that some people will start it and say, this isn't for me, and they'll give up on it like, earlier than later, right? So that's why It's a good point that you're making. So, what are some of those things that they might experience that they'll be, to give them a chance? So that they might recognize these and say, okay, Mark said this, it's normal, it can happen.
Yeah. So hunger, obviously, and also irritability, maybe can't concentrate really well. You can drink coffee and tea, the lung doesn't have any calories in it. So, it turns out, it used to be you'd hear this idea that breakfast is the most important meal,
We
but
all
it
grew up
turned,
learning that, right? That was what we all learned forever, as Gen
yeah.
Xers at least.
So a couple points there. One, from an evolutionary perspective, it's the least likely meal. Animals don't wake up and there's food waiting for them, right? So they have to be able to function well in a food-deprived state. Their brains and bodies have to function well, right? And so evolution selected for individuals whose brains and bodies do function well in a food-deprived state. Right, because they were successful and got food. Okay, that's number one. Number two, turns out if you go back in the literature, the study suggesting that breakfast is the most important meal, two things. One, they were sponsored by Kellogg's or other breakfast food companies. Number two, they would take like these, I don't know, high school age kids. Our middle school age kids, and what they do is who normally had all been eating breakfast, and then one day they'll have half of them not eat breakfast, the other half eat breakfast, and then and before lunchtime, they'll do this kind of semi-quantitative evaluation of the kids' ability to concentrate or focus on what the teacher's teaching them. And not surprisingly, the ones who didn't eat breakfast, they're hungry, irritable, can't concentrate. It's because they're not adapted to it. It's a big change. So anyway, I think those studies are like flawed in a number of ways.
So breakfast is really a man-made construct.
Yeah, three meals a day is a man-made construct. In fact, a colleague of mine, Robert Sapolsky, who is at Stanford, he did a lot of, he's a primatologist, essentially. He'd go to Africa and study baboons in the wild. He mainly was looking at stress and so on, and like the hierarchy. You got the alpha male and the subordinates and so on. But I asked him, what's the eating pattern of these baboons in the wild, and he said, oh, they eat all within like 3 or 4 hours each day, and then the rest of the day they're just laying around or grooming each other or whatever. So they're just kind of naturally, of course they have a they're an environment apparently they have enough food available, but they just kind of naturally do that.
Interesting. And so his research shows that it also is very beneficial that humans should do the same.
It's consistent with, yeah, humans doing the same. Andrew. Right. So I consider intermittent fasting kind of similar to exercise in a general way, something that's good for general health and people can incorporate into their lifestyle. And with exercise, if you've been sedentary and then you go out and try to run 3 miles, you're not going to feel very good. Right, and there's some people who won't get into exercise just because of that. They say, I don't, it's too hard, I don't feel good. But once they get adapted to it, not only is it easier for them to do, but they actually like it. And if they then don't exercise, they start to feel bad and they realize how much it's helped them. I think it's similar with intermittent fasting that like if someone goes on intermittent fasting and stick with it, they'll find their general health and their mood even will improve. They'll feel better about themselves and than if, like, if exercise, I've had this happen a couple times in my life, because my whole life I exercised, as a distance runner, and where I got injured and couldn't exercise, and like my mood very quickly,
Thanks.
within a few weeks, went down. And we actually know at least a lot of what's going on in the brain to explain the effects of exercise and intermittent fasting on mood and cognitive ability. So maybe this is a good point we can talk
Sure.
about.
Yeah, go for it.
All right, so there's a number of things going on. One that's common between exercise and intermittent fasting, there's a protein called BDNF, brain-derived neurotrophic factor. There's literally thousands of publications on this protein because it's very important in the brain development, in the wiring of neural circuits. It promotes the growth of
In the brain.
axons and dendrites and formation of synapses. It's also critical for learning and memory. And it's produced and released from the neurons in response to activity in the neurons, exercising the neurons. And this is one thing that turns out to be very interesting. So what happens in muscle cells when you exercise them regularly is there's tremendous overlap with what happens in your neurons in your brain. It's actually a stress on the cells. And it's a good stress. One thing that happens is BDNF production goes way up. And that is important for forming new synapses, for maintaining synapses, and for protecting neurons against aging and the kinds of stress that occur, say, with a stroke or chronic, uncontrollable psychosocial stress, which is bad stress. So that's one thing. This n nerve cell growth factor levels are increased with exercise, with intermittent fasting. Another is that the number of mitochondria within individual neurons increases in response to exercise and intermittent fasting. So
That's
mitochondria is,
energy. Yeah, I was going to say, can you explain what mitochondria is?
yeah, mitochondria are the energy factory of the cell. That's where carbohydrates, fats, and in some cases proteins can be used to produce what's called ATP, which is a, I can get into the chemistry, but
Energy.
essentially
Yeah,
it's
energy.
the energy that drives
The cell.
pretty much every process in cells requires energy. And so, yeah, we published a couple papers on that, and that was known for a long time that in muscle cells, when you exercise them over time, not just with one bout of exercise, over time, the number of mitochondria in each individual muscle cell increases. And that makes sense. Then that cell is able to produce more energy that allows stronger contraction or better endurance longer over longer time period.
I'm so happy that you're mentioning muscles because in my research, when I'm writing my book now, and I just finished a chapter that talked about sarcopenia and talked about how it's now we now know that muscle loss is related to actually cognitive health and dementia in the brain and memory loss. So I'm happy that you brought it up because this is such an important point for women who are in perimenopause and menopause because we know that we lose muscle as we go into this phase of life, but the connection between our muscle strength and our brain health is so important. So, Mark, thank you for mentioning that because I cannot drive that point home enough. And you know what's interesting is I look at my father-in-law who is 88, and in the last few years, he's really gone downhill. And one of the things that, or the biggest thing that we saw was he has no muscle strength, not even in his vocal cords. He couldn't even speak. He lived alone. He spent a lot of time alone, especially during, from 2020 to 2023. It was very hard on him. And he just went completely downhill. And now his family, are my husband and his siblings are seeing the detrimental effects that that had on his overall health. And we know that muscle strength is correlated to longevity. So I'm so happy you brought that up. And it is very important, especially for women who are in this phase of life, to hear that.
Yeah, I agree 100%. One area of research that's pretty interesting is number labs now have identified, well, essentially proteins that are released from muscle cells in response to exercise into the blood, and they can get in the brain and do good things. So there's that connection. Yeah, so build and maintain muscle, you need to exercise. There have been now many studies where some people were worried about the idea, well, if you do intermittent fasting, maybe you're not, even though it doesn't make sense when you really understand the physiology, or maybe you'll lose muscle because you're not getting enough energy or protein or something. But there have been many studies now where they have people do resistance training. Most of them are just in like young adults, I think, but I don't know if there's any in postmenopausal women specifically. But anyway, the bottom line is that intermittent fasting eating pattern is conducive to building and maintaining muscle mass. It has no detrimental effect on that. And it turns out that bodybuilders, Arnold Schwarzenegger, a long time ago, I'm sure he probably still lifts weight. And others, they found, I guess, just by accident, that if they don't eat breakfast and then do their weightlifting, like in the late morning, and then they eat after that, they take a lot of probably too much protein, in my opinion, for long-term health. But anyway, they found they build muscles really well, and they reduce their body fat. Because they're working out in a fasted state. We haven't really talked about this metabolic switch.
Okay, yeah, I'd like to because that's a big part for us too. It's important for us too.
Yeah, so we kind of define, so what constitutes a period without eating anything or very little sufficient to be considered fasting from a scientific standpoint? And it is a period with no or little food sufficient for your body to switch from using glucose to fats and ketones as energy source. So we take blood samples and measure the ketones. And if you don't eat breakfast in the mid to late morning, the ketones will be going up. If you exercise when you've been fat, you haven't eaten breakfast and then exercise, then the ketones go up more. So, and that's getting back to evolution. That's kind of the no normal state for particularly predators, right? Where they may once a week, maybe they'll kill a prey animal and then gorge. So they're in a fasted state for a long time, and then they're exercising. And we think the ketones, well, we published the paper, and then a group up at NYU at the same time published papers showing that one of the ketones produced during fasting increases levels of BDNF in the brain. And so we think at least one factor that's gets into the blood during fasting that's definitely good for neurons is the ketones. And there are now clinical trials of ketone esters, essentially giving people ketones, people with Alzheimer's disease or age-related cognitive impairment.
So keto, can you explain what ketones are? I mean, it's we for you know, you may have heard of it because of ketosis and the keto diet, but can you explain exactly what it is,
Okay.
what they are?
So in your fat cells, there are triglycerides. People have heard of that before, diglycerides. And when your liver gets depleted of glucose, which takes like 10 to 12 hours of fasting, then those fats in the fat cells. They're broken down into smaller fats we call fatty acids that have like 8 to 10 carbons, if you want to get to the chemistry. And then those, and there's all your cells have active ways of taking up these ketones, and very efficiently moving the ketones. So the ket, sorry, so both the fatty acids and ketones. So the fatty acids go into liver cells, and the liver cells then metabolize them to what are called ketones. There's two ketones that can be used as energy sources for cells. One is called beta hydroxybutyrate, or BHB, and the other is called acetoacetate. So then those get into cells and get into mitochondria and are used to produce ATP instead of glucose when you're
Energy.
in the
And
fasting.
so that helps to give you the energy instead of the glucose. So is the key that you want to be, when you talk about metabolic switching, can you explain, like, is it something you want to stay in that state where your ketones are higher for a long time? Or should it be like, okay, once you're in that state, then you should eat to that? So explain what that means, the metabolic.
Okay, so we think that, and we've, so we had a review article in New England Journal of Medicine a few years ago, me and a colleague of mine at National Institute on Aging, and we had a figure, and it should be available. The vast majority of my publications should be available to anyone if you just go to PubMed and put in Mattson MP. I'm the only
How many
MP
do you
Mattson.
have? How many are there?
It's close to 1,000 if you and
Amazing.
but anyway, so we think that switching back and forth between ketogenic state and a non-ketogenic state over times, weeks and months and years may be a way to optimize health. And if we go back to the exercise analogy again, so with exercise, your muscle cells don't get bigger and stronger and better endurance during the exercise. It's during the recovery period, resting. So, but if you don't exercise, the cells don't get the stress and the signals associated with that stress affecting gene expression and so on that enable mitochondrial biogenesis or increase proteins that slide back and forth to contract the muscles. So we think the same is true with intermittent fasting, that switching back and forth between stress resistance, conserve resources mode during the fasting and growth and something we call cellular plasticity during the recovery phase, so eating after fasting, the switching back and forth is very conducive to optimal health, whether it's exercise or fasting.
So once you're in that state where your body's burning, releasing ketones and not burning glucose anymore, once you're there, then it's okay to just keep going back and forth. You don't have to stay there for a certain period of time.
Well, this gets back to the question you asked earlier about comparing daily time restricted eating to 5-2 and so on. In the animal studies where this has been looked at some, there you do reach a point where, well, rats and mice will die within 3 to 4 days of complete fasting. Okay, so they can't tolerate, and humans can go weeks and even months. But I don't think that's a good idea to be doing that regularly, because then you don't have the probably. So then what happens? You'll have all these conserved resources, stress resistance signaling going on during a long fast, whatever, 2 weeks, 3 weeks. Okay. And then you go back to eating regularly, for example, and you'll only go into growth plasticity mode for a short time period. It's not going to last for the same amount of time that you had fasted, right? So kind of my current thinking anyway is that shorter periods like 16 hours a day fasting, 16 to 18 every day is a good way to go.
Can you plateau by doing the same amount of fasting every day? So if you're doing 16-8 every day, is it good to change up your fasting methods?
Don't know.
Okay. In terms of exercise.
I thought you're going to say you're plateauing in terms of like, no further increase in improvement in health with continued intermittent fasting. But I think it's kind of like if you look at your lifespan, right? If you exercise when you're middle age, it actually helps you even when you're older if you stop exercising. So it's kind of diminishing returns type of thing. I think that's kind of the same way to think about this.
So to be clear, when it comes to exercising for we're gonna say for women over 40, but when it comes to exercising and intermittent fasting, is it better to exercise in a fasted state, or is it better to eat a carbohydrate-rich meal or protein-rich meal before you exercise?
I think it's better to exercise in a fasted state. I coached high school cross country for a while, and I get these parents, and this isn't that long ago, is when I, knew a lot of data on intermittent fasting and what happens with the body and brain. And so these parents would encourage their kids. So the practices and the races are in late afternoon. Okay. And so I have these parents that would, right before a meet, cross country meet, within a few hours of a cross country meet, they'd have candy bars for their kids. And I don't think it's a good idea to have, and I ran a lot. I used to do a lot of trail running, like half marathon, that kind of length. And I found that I ran better not eating anything before, because I think what happens if you go start exercising when you're not in a ketogenic state, your exercise will quite rapidly deplete your internal glucose stores because the glucose is always used first before the fats are used.
They'll have more ketones or they'll be released.
Yeah, so if you're already in a ketogenic state, you'll already have ketones up. If you're not in a ketogenic state, the switch will occur while you're competing. And I think this has a lot to do with this notion of like second wind and so on, that it's actually doesn't have anything to do with your breathing. It has to do with the energy metabolism and that you're. And I found this too, like when I was in a ketogenic state, when I run, that like at some point, say like 40 minutes into the run, I'd start to feel and run better. And I think what's happening is you're getting it completely into a ketogenic state. And again, go back to evolution, right? All these animals are chasing the deer or whatever. I don't know what, cougar chasing deer around, or wolves chasing buffalo and surrounding them. They're expending a lot of energy in a ketogenic state. And like wolves are really interesting, right? Because they, and I've written about this too. So they're social animals. And during evolution, individuals who cooperated with others to, surround and kill prey had a survival advantage. And so I think that, had something to do with brain evolution, and the social brain actually had to do with cooperating to get food. With humans, like we invented the first tools invented by humans. I have a chapter in that in my book, The Intermittent Fasting Revolution. on evolution. But anyway, the first tools invented by humans, as far as we know, had to do with acquiring or processing food, right? Arrows, stones, bow and arrow. And then even when the agricultural revolution came in, like all the early stuff that, so I think food scarcity was the kind of a major driving force for brain evolution, including human
That
brain
is
evolution.
fascinating. Like, if you think about it, that is fascinating to think, right? So it's
Yeah.
scarcity that actually helped the brain develop faster and evolve, which is pretty interesting. So I have three papers that you wrote here out of your thousand. And what was fascinating to me is you looked at things like, reducing, so this was the fasting mechanism. So reducing oxidative stress, reducing inflammation, optimizing energy metabolism, cellular protection. So what would you say? So those are, incredible, really incredible benefits to doing fasting. And when it comes to perimenopause and menopause, these are all symptoms. Like, we have over 100 symptoms of perimenopause and menopause according to our research. So what would you say, to the women who are listening now, what advice would you give them and reasons that they should start to look at incorporating intermittent fasting in their life? And by the way, I'm going to side note this, when we talked about 16:8 and 18:6 and 5:2, what would be the shortest period that someone could fast? Could it be 12 hours while they're sleeping? Like, what would be that? Is there still a benefit for them to go shorter so they could still reap these benefits of reducing inflammation and reducing oxidative stress, et cetera?
Yeah, so 14 hours of fasting is better than 12. This is based on mainly animal studies, but also measuring ketone levels as kind of a readout.
Right.
And so a 6 hour eating window, 18 hours a day in the fasted state, it's something that I think anybody can do pretty much. Once and they can adapt to it. And that's a sufficient time window to get enough calories and, obviously eating a healthy diet so that you can maintain your body weight, maintain your muscle mass, or even build muscle mass. If you go any narrower time window, it really gets hard to get enough good kinds of food in your stomach. I eat kind of a Mediterranean diet type approach, and probably your listeners and viewers have heard of the blue zones, right? This has got a lot
Where
of
people live
press.
the longest.
Yeah, and all of those, if you look at that, and there's been whatever documentaries, I can't remember the author, but anyway, in all those places, whether it's Okinawa or in this place in Italy or in the Loma Linda group, what Seventh-day Adventist. Their diet is mostly complex carbohydrates from vegetables, beans, root crops, whatever, sweet potatoes, that kind of thing. And not much red meat at all. And so I'm kind of down on the ketogenic diets myself. I don't think it's a good idea long term over years and years and years. And there are a lot of good things in fruits and vegetables, chemicals, and I've written about this too. This could be a whole nother podcast, but the chemicals in fruits and vegetables that are good for our health, the reason they're in the fruits and vegetables is to keep insects, herbivores, omnivores like us from eating the vital parts of the plant or, eating too much. So they're kind of natural pesticides, actually. But we evolved, it was to our advantage during evolution to be able to eat these plant, whether it's a fruit, vegetable, because they have energy and other things, fats and proteins in some cases. And so we've actually evolved several ways to protect ourselves from any adverse effects of these chemicals. Wrote an article for Scientific American about 10 years ago on this think it was in July of 2015, if I remember right. But anyway, so ketogenic diets, you're not getting any of these chemicals that seem to stimulate our cells in ways that are good. Also, from the standpoint of cardiovascular disease, if ketogenic diet, as far as cardiovascular health, it should be mainly fish, right? Or
Omega-3s,
olive
not
oil.
unsaturated fats, yep.
Yeah, olive oil. Right. So anyway, getting back to your question, my opinion is like 6 to 8 hour eating window
Is
will
ideal.
definitely, enable all these health benefits we've been talking about. And again, a key thing is being able to adapt to that eating pattern. If you normally, been eating breakfast, lunch, dinner, evening snack, it takes a while. Man, another piece of advice, do it with a friend or even people, women who are still working at work. Silicon Valley, a lot of those big companies, a lot of the employees do intermittent fasting, and it's kind of a thing. It's like exercise, right? For many people, it's more enjoyable to do exercise with someone else. Like my
Absolutely.
wife's playing a lot of pickleball lately. And, it's good for your physical health and mental health. But yeah, so this can be something people, you should maybe get together with a buddy and say, okay, let's do this. And then you've got kind of reinforcement. So,
Exactly.
yeah.
And to go back to the benefits, so we talked about the oxidative stress, reducing inflammation, brain health. What are some other, and you mentioned also about weight earlier. Can you talk a little bit about that and then some of those other benefits?
Yeah. So, weight, when you're in ketogenic state, you're reducing the amount of fat in your fat cells. And reduction in abdominal fat is very important for health. Fat in your belly, it's called white fat. It's bad. It can cause a lot of inflammation and so on. One thing that we haven't mentioned yet is I kind of mentioned it indirectly, the stress resistance conserve resources mode. So there's a process in cells called autophagy where damaged molecules, dysfunctional mitochondria are gotten rid of. It's kind of like a cleansing of potentially toxic substances.
Clearing out cellular waste, right?
Yeah. So essentially, the cellular waste is moved to a garbage disposal system called the lysosome, which is it's essentially an acid bath. You know how in some murder mysteries they'll dissolve the body. I'm getting a little gross here, but to completely eliminate any evidence, you put hydrochloric acid in the bathtub and put the body in there, and it just
And this is happening
dissolves.
in our stomach, you're saying
It,
the acid bath.
in our in our cells,
In
each
our, oh,
cell,
in our cells. Okay,
in
fantastic.
a controlled manner. The only dead or damaged molecules or mitochondria are moved to the acid bath.
Okay.
And so that kind of clears out garbage, cellular garbage.
How long does it take? So how long in the to be in the fasted state does it take for autophagy to kick in?
It takes like 12 to 16 hours.
And that can happen on a daily basis, right? Autophagy, we can, so that happens on a, okay, so that cellular removal of that cellular waste happens on a regular basis by going into that fasted
Yeah,
state.
the Japanese scientist who got Nobel Prize for his work on autophagy, the way he discovered it, he was studying yeast cells under the microscope, and yeast eat, well, they eat glucose, and right, you put yeast in your bread or whatever, and then they essentially respire, they give off gas, carbon dioxide, and then you get kind of the bread gets bigger. That's essentially gas bubbles, right, in the bread. But anyway, he found that in these yeast, they have a They have these lysosomes. You can see them under the microscope. They're very small normally. But when he deprived them of glucose, then the size of that lysosome got a lot bigger. And that was really the discovery of autophagy, was by depriving the cells of glucose. And of course, when you're in a fasted state, you're depriving cells throughout your body and brain are reducing glucose availability.
Do or does genetics play a role when it comes to fasting? So, for example, can some people fast less, or can, does it work better for some people?
Yeah, that's a great question. I am not aware of any data on that. It is a good question. There is some variability in how people respond to intermittent fasting, I guess, or at least th there needs to be some formal gene analysis study. So that kind of study could be done because essentially just what you need though is you need a lot of people to go try intermittent fasting, and it should be in a controlled setting ideally, and then kind of divide up based on how well they respond to the intermittent fasting in terms of various endpoints, whether it's blood work or brain function or whatever, inflammation, and then take their do genome-wide sequence all the genes in their DNA, which now can be done very quickly. It's quite amazing, actually. And then, yeah, see if there's any genes that one person has that doesn't respond well to fasting versus another. I think that's a really good question. And most laboratory animal studies with rats and mice, they're genetically homogeneous. So they're not like people where, we interbreed, right? And have for a long time. And so there's a lot of genetic variability. One reason that the scientists use mice or rats that have exactly the same genes with no variation is because it actually reduces the inter-animal variability in whatever you're measuring. And can when you do the statistics, that's a good thing, because if you have like one animal or in a human study, one person that's like the response is way different than everybody else, then that makes it harder to know whether the effect is significant. So.
How many animal studies are there are, and you may not know this, but it's a very specific question, but how many animal studies versus human studies are there on fasting?
Well, there are a lot more animal studies still, but the animal studies are not going up very fast, and the human studies are skyrocketing.
Great.
Yeah.
I'd like to see a lot more. I mean, I know there are some for women in perimenopause and menopause, but it would be great to see a lot more in that area,
Yeah,
particularly.
the so as I mentioned, I was at the NIH for a long time, and so obviously I knew a lot of people there, including at, higher up administration up to the director. And so I retired in 2019, but just a few years before that, the NIH set aside a lot of money specifically for clinical trials of intermittent fasting in
Amazing.
humans. And that's why there's a lot more trials, because there's a lot more NIH funding specifically targeting that, because the point is NIH thinks it's very important research. So that's a good thing.
Amazing. I love hearing that. Just two more questions for you, and then we'll wrap it up. When you mentioned earlier that you can have coffee and tea when you're fasting. Is it important to do something like a clean fast, or I know that term has been used before, where you're really, really following the rules, or is it, what are the rules? I mean, is it, I've heard you can't have more than 30 calories, you can't have more than 25 calories, you can't have anything like, so what are the rules that we should look at following?
Okay, I'll have to tell you my rules, because there's
Okay.
probably other people have other rules. But my rule is no carbohydrates during the fasting period.
Okay, so you can have protein?
Well, or protein, I don't know. Some people are putting like medium chain triglycerides, MCT oil in their coffee or tea, and that should keep you in a ketogenic state. Those are actually the fatty acid precursors to the ketones. On the other hand, from the brain standpoint, we think that ketones isn't the only explanation for why intermittent fasting is benefiting the brain. We think that I've shown actually there's changes in neural network activity that occur during the fasting period, and those changes are stimulating brain cells in ways that we think contribute to their benefits. So I'll just tell you what I do. I just have water or green tea. That's it during my fasting period.
During your fasting period. And is it better to fast earlier in the day than later? You said you fast from like 6 o'clock onwards. Does it matter if you start your fast at 9 o'clock at night? Have you seen anything?
Well, the circadian, it's definitely not good to eat a lot in within like 3 or 4 hours where you go to sleep. One thing, I used to have acid reflux. A long time ago, I used to eat a lot because I'd work in the lab all day and then come home. And so, but then I found this, make sure I don't eat anything within 3 hours of the time I go to sleep, then I don't have acid reflux. So I think it's just for a number of reasons, it's better not to eat late in the evening.
Is there anything that obviously we didn't cover a lot. We didn't. Is there anything that you would like to leave our listeners with that we didn't cover today when it comes to brain health, intermittent fasting, or anything else?
Yeah, brain health, physical exercise, moderation in calorie intake, intermittent fasting, and keeping your brain intellectually challenged is very important throughout life. And socially engaged is important too. So those are the best things people can do for their brain health. We did a lot of work on basic research on Alzheimer's disease, working to understand what's going on in the brain. And from a long time ago, I knew it wasn't going to be easy or maybe even possible for drug companies to make a drug that's going to halt the progression of Alzheimer's disease or reverse it. Because by the time someone's symptomatic, there's already a lot of damage done that we don't know how to repair. Maybe in the future with stem cells or something, we can figure out. But so lifelong brain health requires lifelong effort on the person's part. Don't expect any miracles that are going to, cure Alzheimer's or Parkinson's anytime soon.
How does alcohol affect the brain?
Depends how much you drink. So this notion that like one cup of wine a day or one drink a day is better for health than no drinks, I think that's been kind of refuted with recent studies. So my opinion is no alcohol is the best.
Thank you. Thank you for doing this, Mark. I appreciate your time. And I'm going to take you up on your offer, by the way. I don't know if it was an offer, but you're like, we could do a whole other podcast about fruits and vegetables. I would love to do that because looking at the phytonutrients and eating the rainbow, I mean, as a nutritionist, that's what we talk about all the time, right? And there's a lot of information and overwhelming information out there that I think it would be cool to dive deep into that a little bit more. So thank you so much for doing this.
You're welcome. I'll send you a couple articles we've written on the chemicals in fruits and vegetables.
I love it. Thank you.
Okay, Andrea.